time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Linda McDonald Lewis. Linda McDonald Lewis is a poet, historian, and storyteller. She owns the Celtic Story in Seaside, Oregon, and has dedicated the past 20 years to teaching Americans about Scotland through her shop, performances, seminars, and lectures. She's been asked to read before Scotland's Parliament, and her work was cited last year at a United Nations tribunal on the right to a fair trial. She is a contributor to the book Arts of Resistance, Poets, Portraits, Landscapes of Modern Scotland. And here to talk about her new book, The Warriors and Wordsmiths of Freedom, The Birth and Growth of Democracy. Linda, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
It's my pleasure to be here, Mike.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing your book, The Warriors and Wordsmiths of Freedom?
Well, I was actually asked by the publisher over in Edinburgh, Scotland, Gavin McDougall for Lewith Press, to start working on a series of books about the history, mythology, and folklore of Scotland for the American and Canadian market. So that was my motivation, to write down some of the things I've been teaching people all these years, you know, over the counter in my store and in the performances I've been doing. Scotland just got their parliament back from the English for the first time since 1707 on September 11th, 1997. I was there in Stirling during the time of the vote and when the gavel fell, and they were able to get their parliament back. So that was part of the motivation as well, is it's very important for people to understand Scotland at this point because they're reformulating their government and bringing a lot of the legislative power from Westminster back up to Edinburgh.
So I think I want to get into, have you tell us about Scotland's history, and because in your book you believe that Scotland was a primary influence in our own constitution here in the United States.
Right, that's very correct. You have to go back to the early days of the Celtic realm, where originally there were two deities, the god and the goddess, and they were equal. There was never any question of man versus woman. There was a time when ability outranked gender. If a woman had a warrior spirit, she'd be on the front lines fighting with the men. And her brother, if he had propensity for cooking, he'd be back at the campsite, yeah? Children, as well as a man and woman, had equal voice on the council. And back in the day, they were tribal people, yeah? And each one of the different clans was considered to be a realm unto itself. And they had a chief. And the chief was brought to power by the clan. And the clan was considered to be a family. There was a bloodline connection between the chief and the people. And the chiefs were considered to be the first among equals. When we think of the word chief, we try to put a feudal mindset on it, where there's nobility and the ruler with a capital R, you know, chief with a capital C. But the truth of the matter was that they were of the people, and they worked for the people. And if they did something against their own people, they would be cast out, and a new chief would be brought to the realm.
Yeah. So go back and give us a sense of history. I think the bulk of myself included, people listening, our history of Scotland is pretty much based on the film Braveheart.
Right.
So how much did they get right in that film, and maybe start back in that time period?
My book fortunately takes it back a bit further, where it shows what caused the Wars of Independence. Usually when you read stories, it starts with William Wallace raising his head to try to free his country, yeah. But there was a reason why they were in the situation they were in. Alexander III had died, unfortunately, in a freak accident, and it left the throne empty in Scotland. So there was quite a rise of the people that were the formidable families to try to prove that they had the hereditary right to be the king, and it caused a lot of problems in Scotland. You know, three major families, the Balliols, the Comyn, and the Bruce, were contending for the throne. And this kind of squabble went on for a while. And what most people don't understand is it was actually the leaders of Scotland that invited Edward the Longshanks, Edward the First, into the debate. And he was very pleased at this because he believed that it was only proper for a king to choose a king. So all the documents were set out to his scholars, and after looking through them, they chose Balliol. And the reason they chose him is because Edward knew that he was easily swayed. And he was known later as the Tomb Tabar, or the Empty Garment, also known as the Puppet King. Because every time Edward wanted something done, Balliol would make sure it was done. But it left him in a very, very strange position as well. Because every time he sided with Edward, he would upset his people. And every time he sided with his own people, he would upset Edward. So his reign didn't last long, and it left the throne empty again. Because of all this struggle, a fight broke out in Scotland, which started the Wars of Independence. Edward marched on Scotland. It all started because Edward wanted to raise troops from Scotland to fight France. And that was the last straw with the Scottish leaders. They said that they wouldn't do that. And they went behind their backs, behind his back, and actually created a alliance with France where they agreed that either one of them would raise up to support the others against a common foe, and that common foe was England. So that started the Wars of Independence. It really upset Edward, so he marched on Scotland. And because of that, the struggle, William Wallace came into the battlefield and started working really, really hard to free his country. There was a proverb that was taught to William Wallace by his uncle when he was very young that goes like this. Freedom is best, I tell thee true, of all things to be won. Never find yourself in the bonds of slavery, my son. And he lived that proverb all the way through his life. And when William Wallace was executed, or murdered, as we say in Scotland, by the English in 1305, Robert the Bruce picked up the fight and took on the, you know, many battles happened, and there's great stories about Robert the Bruce and the spider in the book that is an old legend that is where we get the saying, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And he took the ended up at the Bannockburn in 1314, and even though they won the fight very, very well there, the English were still pressing their issue with Scotland, and the Pope was actually backing them. And that was where the Declaration of Arbroath came, and it was sent to the Pope, and it was the first statement of democracy in the world. And it took on all the cultural beliefs and ideals of the Celtic people from way, way back, all the way through when the Scots and the Picts and all the other people came together. And it stated in it, now the most famous line in the Declaration is, for so long as but 100 of us remain alive, we will never again submit ourselves to English dominion. We fight, but not for glory, nor riches, nor honors, but only and alone we fight for freedom, which no good man gives up without his life. Now, if we spin forward from 1320 to Valley Forge with George Washington, when his men were freezing and outnumbered, he wrote this statement and sent it by courier to another commander, and it stated, if all else fails, I will retreat up the Valley of Virginia, plant my flag at the Blue Ridge, and take my last stand for liberty among the Scot-Irish that live in that region, where it's known in their culture, to fight the tyranny of the British until the last man stands to draw a trigger. Now, the similarity between those two statements is uncanny. And that may be the for so long as but 100 of us remain alive is the most famous statement from the document. It's the one that gets the blood up, yeah? But there's much more important statements made in the document of the Declaration of Arbroath. It states in it that we, the people of Scotland, brought the great King Robert the Bruce to the throne of Scotland because he believes in the culture, beliefs, and the laws of the Scottish people. He's fought hard and fast to return our liberties to us. We will defend him with our own consent and our lives. But if he's ever to side against us and aid our enemies, we will cast him from the throne as a subverter and choose another from our ranks to lead us. Now that's democracy, and it was never stated like that before. Before this point, the kings were looked like they were brought by God. And if you came up against the king, then you were coming up against the will of God. I call that the almighty brick wall that was just unpassable. But this statement showed that the king of Scotland, which is, they were actually called the king and queen of Scots, because Scotland is looked as being it belongs to the people. And the king is chosen from the people to lead them, not to be power over them. And so that's, you know, that's the Declaration of Independence was a reflection of that. And a lot of people in Scotland will say that Jefferson was a bit of a plagiarist because he took most of the statements that were made in the Declaration of Arbroath and brought them forward into more up-to-date language and stated it in the Declaration of Independence. Now, another key thing to know is that James Wilson, who keyed the phrase, we the people, and wrote the Constitution, was from St. Andrews, Scotland. 50% of the people that signed the Declaration of Independence were either directly from Scotland or descended from people that moved from Scotland over here right before the Revolutionary War. And 9 of the 13 governors for the original colonies here were Scots.
So there's some pretty heavy Scottish influence that in all this that we doesn't seem to have been passed on in our history books.
Aye, that's true. And because Scotland just got their parliament back, I think it's important now's the time that people understand this, the influence that they've had on the ideals of democracy and more particularly the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence here in this country.
Why do you think such a delay on getting their parliament back, not till 87?
1997,
oh,
actually.
Sorry. Aye.
I cover this in the book. Because of political struggles back in the 1700s and the failure of a scheme called the Darien Scheme, where they were trying to, in Scotland, they were trying to compete with all the great tradesmen of the world, Dutch East India Trade Company, Hudson Bay Trade Company. They started their own trade, but it failed terribly. And one of the reasons it failed is because the English were moving against to make sure that it failed. Because of that, it put Scotland in much of a bankrupt state. And there was a push for the union of the parliament at that time. And I mean, you have to understand, too, the arena at that time, James Stuart, who was the hereditary king of Scotland, had been usurped out of the throne because he was Catholic, and the religious, the evil religious thing started wielding its head. And there was a man who had married James's daughter, her name was Mary. A man named William of Orange was put on the throne. And that had started a huge upheaval in Scotland. And at this time, at the same time, the Darien Scheme failed, and there was a push by the English to have the parliaments unionized between Scotland and Westminster down in London. And one of the ways they got the unionization of the parliament passed was they promised all the merchants that were in Edinburgh that had put money up for the Darien Scheme that failed, that put them in a bankrupt state, they promised to give them that money back with interest. And that is where Robert Burns' poem, Parcel of Rogues in a Nation, Bought and Sold for English Gold, that was where that line came from, was his reflection of what had happened during that time. And because we lost our parliament, unfortunately, a lot of the people in Scotland, in fact, the majority of all the schools, have not been taught Scottish history. There's been a huge void there, where they were taught more of the English and what they call the British history, yeah? The Hundred Year War, the Roar of the Roses and that. And so, through this 300 years of being under the thumb of the English and losing sight of their own history, a lot of things have gone awry. I compare it a lot of times to the Native Americans here, you know, where their culture was kind of depleted because of the them losing their rights and all that. And all the legislative power went down to London. And right now, since 1997, it's slowly starting to come back to Scotland. In the beginning, the Scottish government was called the Scottish Executive because it was considered to be an executive branch, you know, after the Parliament vote went through, of the Westminster legislation. But more recently, in the last couple of years, it's now called the Scottish government. So it's a slow process, and it's good that it's a slow process. If it was a fast and abrupt process, it would probably create a war. And you don't want that, you know, in this day and age. It's better to wean themselves away. We're still in the process of it. You know, it's only been 13 years. They just celebrated the 10th anniversary of the new Parliament building down in Holyrood in Edinburgh last year. So, I mean, this is all fresh. And it's very, very important, I think, that the Americans understand the influence that the Scots have had here, especially in this time when they're reformulating their government and casting their eyes back and saying, okay, this is what we've just come out of, casting their eyes forward and saying, this is where we want to go.
So, getting back to William Wallace, obviously in the movie, Braveheart, he is painted as the most important Scot ever. Is that your take on it as well?
Well, he was considered to be the Scotland's liberator. Right? He laid his life on the line. There's not too many people in the history of mankind that you can look at and say this man dedicated his life to freeing his nation, you know, and gave his life for that. Yeah, and no holds barred. Just did everything that he could to free his nation. There's a great document that was written back by a man named Blind Harry in the 1400s and then updated in 1722 by a man named William Hamilton of Gilbertfield, where they took it from the ancient Scots dialect into a more modern Scots dialect, and it's called Blind Harry's Wallace, and that is what the movie Braveheart was taken from. Randall Wallace told me the story where he found one of those documents in a library in California, and it was slated for incineration. They were going to destroy it because nobody had checked it out since it was donated. So he took it home, and this is where he got his information. Now, Blind Harry got his information for this epic poem about Wallace from a thing called the Blair Chronicles, and Blair actually was with Wallace during the Wars of Independence and was going to try to get him canonized as a saint. Unfortunately, the Blair Chronicles have not surfaced. We don't know where they're at, so there is a bone of contention about whether, you know, Blind Harry's story was true or not. But most of it's been, it's been documented by other things that are known about Wallace. And more recently, a letter, see, we never knew, after the defeat at Falkirk, which you see in the movie Braveheart, Wallace escaped, and he left Scotland to go to France to get help from the French for the battle there. And there was never any documented proof that he actually left. It was like one of those things that was considered to be a legend. Well, recently they found a letter that was a letter of safe conduct or safe passage given to him by King Philip in France. And it's in a drawer in London, and we're trying to get it returned back to Scotland as an important historical document that can be viewed by the Scottish people.
Yeah, it seems to be a reoccurring theme that the victors in wars tend to rewrite the history books as well as go through and acquire most of the historical items, and put them in safe places.
Longshanks took the Stone of Scone, or the Stone of Destiny as we know it by, and this stone was very important to the Scots because it would sit under the coronation throne, and the kings of Scotland always sat on it. And the old legend is that if the wrong king sat on the stone, it would cry out, but the rightful king would be accepted. And it's also known that the power, wherever the stone lies, so does the power of Scotland. And so Longshanks reefed this and took it down and put it under the throne in Westminster, believing that he would take the power of Scotland and all that magic that went with it. Hey, and it was taken in 1296, and it was just brought back with much pomp and circumstance in 1996. And I think the Braveheart had a lot to do with that. But there's also a man that's a solicitor named Robbie the Pict that created quite a flack about the Stone of Destiny and had deemed it as being stolen by Longshanks. And there is a law where if something is reported as being stolen, it has to be investigated. So that created quite a flack back in Scotland, too. It's kind of a bit of a giggle, too, you know?
So clarify the Picts. How do they fit into Scotland's history?
Well, the Picts, we don't know a lot about them, and we're in every day that passes, I think we learn a wee bit more through archaeological and linguistic studies. But the Picts were the original. The word Pict means painted one, and that's where the word picture and the word pint came from, because originally on the pint glasses in the UK there was a line called the Pict line to show that there was a full pour, and later it became pint. Yeah. They were ancient people. I think you see them portrayed in the movie King Arthur as having the woad paint. And that was kind of a misnomer in Braveheart, you know, where they have the blue woad paint, which is a vegetable dye, on their faces. That was actually a Pictish thing that was much earlier than the 1300s, when William Wallace was alive. But the Picts, yeah, there were different tribes of the Picts. Two of the original Pictish tribes were the Boer clan and the Cat clan, and the clan Catton. And you'll find now that the clans that descended from those people on their clan badge, if they're from the clan Catton, it says things like, touch not the cat but a glove, which means don't approach me without armor. So there still is some proof, you know, and documentation of this descendancy down through the Picts. One of the tribes was called the Epidi, people of the horse, and their goddess name was Epona. They amalgamated in the 800s under the leadership of Kenneth MacAlpin, and the Picts and the Scots became one. And it was because of that action that we lost a lot of the Pictish particular information, because they segued as one culture. And so, we're not really sure which was which, you know. We can identify the Celtic things that descended down through the 8,000 years, but there's lots of Pictish designs and that that we know are Pictish that we don't really know the meaning of. And there is a Pictish Arts Council back in Scotland that studies this on a regular basis.
Talk a little bit more about Robert Bruce, because he is prominent in your book.
Aye.
So paint his place, expand on that, his place in Scottish history and world history.
Well, he was known as Good King Robert the Bruce, yeah? He was in that struggle of who was going to take the throne. And one of his biggest contenders was John the Red Comyn. There was a lot of bad blood between the two of them. And you'll read in the book that the Bruce actually killed the Comyn at Greyfriars Monastery in Dumfries, yeah? And there's still a lot of debate as to whether the Bruce was just trying to clear the deck so that he could take the throne, or whether the Comyn really deserved being murdered because of the treacherous things he'd done against not only Scotland, but the leaders of Scotland. But, you know, some of these things we'll never know the answer to. And they're debated constantly, and they never have any conclusion, because history is what it is, and there's some things we just don't know, you know. Other things we do know, and we can just talk about what we do know, and the conclusion that came from that. Now, the Bruce worked hard and fast to free Scotland, and it was under his leadership that the Declaration of Arbroath was written. When he died, they mourned him thoroughly throughout Scotland. The tears flowed freely. Every man, woman, and child respected the man for bringing back the liberties of Scotland.
It seems, again, from reading your book, The Warriors and Wordsmiths of Freedom, that a lot of Scottish history is an oral history. Is that
right? We were an oral society. That's why you'll find that during the immigration time, the people's names got all convoluted into 100 different spellings, because we were what they call illiterate, which is not that's not really a negative thing. In fact, you'll find that dyslexia is pretty prolific in Scotland, Ireland, and the Celtic realm. And I think it's because our brains are wired different. I'm a dyslexic. I'm a flaming dyslexic, yeah? Our brains are wired by, for learning by rote. You know, if you show me, I'll know forever. If you tell me a story, I'll remember it. But the reading and writing was not, it wasn't part of the realm. Even the Druids believed that writing down their doctrines would deem them to fade away in the future. That they have to be put to memory and passed from generation to generation so that anyone that is your enemy cannot take them from you.
It seems that that's another commonality with Scotland and other cultures and societies that at one point or appeared to have been conquered, is that they're conquered by powers that used the written word for their historical purposes versus, it's kind of the written word versus oral history.
The old history is written by the victor, yeah. But the folklore and the mythology, I tell people that, you know, a lot of the historians and academics will throw out folklore as being, you know, unestablished, I mean, undocumented, and you can't even really rely on that. But if you look at the word history, it means his story, doesn't it? And I think that one of the reasons that we have a hard time teaching history here is because we look at it wrong. The word history means his story. And that is, if you're thinking about stories, then you're talking about folklore and the legends and things that are passed down by word of mouth from generation to generation. And I tell people the stories are told for three reasons: to comfort the old, to justify the what is going on with the people today, and inspire the young. And I think that history, if it's told correctly, is very exciting. And the young people that have been reading my book, they're telling me, you know, this is the first time I've ever been able to actually absorb the history, because I wrote it the same way that I tell stories from the stage when I'm performing.
So this, with the Scottish Parliament coming back into force in 97, so are we seeing a massive change in Scotland?
I think so. I think there's a lot of pride. You know, the pride actually started. Braveheart was quite a huge impact in Scotland. You know, I've seen a lot of people wearing more kilts and taking pride in their nation since that movie came out. It was like a wake-up call. The world recognized Scotland for the first time and saw the struggle they'd gone through to get their liberties. And unfortunately, you know, it stopped right with the Wars of Independence. And it'd be nice if we get some movies that show about the Jacobite Rebellion and the struggle the Stuarts had with William the Orange. And you still hear about the Orangemen today. And William of Orange, he didn't live that long, yeah? but he's considered, you know, the, when you say Orangeman, in fact, in my book, I say, the people were called Orangemen or Billy's Boys, and those same people that moved over here and settled in the Appalachians and the Ozarks, they brought their stories, their folklore, and their songs about William of Orange with them, and they were later known as hillbillies, because there were Billy's Boys that lived in the hills, yeah? And that's where that word came from, yeah? So, it's really interesting to see the influence that all of this history in Scotland has had on the modern society that we have here today.
So what, I think it's pretty obvious, but what were you pretty much hoping to accomplish with your book?
Well, I just would like, I think that people here in America are sponges for learning. It's just a matter of giving them the right document that they can understand. And, most of the history books that come out of Scotland and Ireland are written by academics, and they are, they're great for hardcore study, but the common man, the working class people in this country are the ones that really, that's the ones that are most prolific, eh? And they're the ones that are interested in their heritage. They're interested in learning about where their people came from. And I see that as being something that's kind of a phenomenon now, 200 years in to this nation, and all of a sudden, because of stories like Braveheart and Rob Roy with Liam Neeson I don't know if you've seen Waterhorse, that was done with Brian Cox about the legend of Loch Ness Monster. And it's a great movie if you haven't seen it. And, there's a new one that came out about Greyfriars Bobby called The Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby. And Bobby was a wee Cairn Terrier from Edinburgh that refused to leave his master's grave for 13 years. And he became world renowned. People would come in from all over the world to watch this wee pup, take off when the gun would sound to set the timepieces and the chronometers in Edinburgh. They had this huge gun that would sound every day. And this wee pup would jump off of the grave and go on this route, the same route that his owner, who was a constable named John Gray, and he'd go on this route, and people would stand and just be amazed that, through winter storms and gales and all that, he refused to leave his master's grave. He was given the freedom of Edinburgh by the provost, and it's a great, great story for children as well as adults. The Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby. It came out in 2006. Disney actually did a version that was not quite true to the history about a shepherd back in the 50s, I think it was, eh? I've seen both, and they're both great, but I do prefer the newer one, because it's more true to the history, yeah.
All right, and in addition to your book, you actually also have a shop in Seaside, Oregon.
Aye, and it's not your typical taffy and T-shirt store there, eh? Nine times out of ten, when you walk through the door, there'll be a huge crowd, and I'll be telling some legend or fable or folklore, or talking to people about their heritage. And I do have documents, and I refer people to their prospective clans, whether they be Irish or Scottish, and can help them trace their history. I'm not a genealogist, and I have to state that I don't do genealogy. But if you bring me your family names, I can try to help you hook up with whatever organizations happen to be here in America. And there's a huge, huge amount of Scottish clans. In fact, there's a Northwest region where they have Scott clan associations, and there's Irish associations. The Welsh just came to Portland with their festival. They go to a different city every year with the Welsh choir, and they were just in Portland 2 weeks ago.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much,
Mike,
for spending time with us this morning.